the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
So sometimes we get asked, what's John Gibbons really like? Well, the way to find out is not to have a conversation with him about the environment or about his book, but to ask him to give all the answers to the Culture Club, and we'll see what comes out of that. John Gibbons, you're very welcome to celebrate just past 5 years as our weekly contributor on The Last Word on the environment. So, Culture Club instead.
Delighted to be here, Matt, and thank you.
Okay, so let's get straight to it, because you don't need any introduction to listeners. First single you ever bought, in so far as you have a precise memory of that.
Yeah, this was Santana's She's Not There. It was in April 1977. I remember it very well, Matt, because it was actually supposedly a birthday present. I was buying a birthday present for my big sister, and I kind of liked that. I think I liked that record more than she did, right? So, and the budgets were tight at that time, so I kind of really... It was a present, yes, but I think I'm the one who got the use out of it. So I remember it very well indeed.
And has that been your approach to present giving ever since?
Well, it's about reusing and recycling. It's all about being efficient. I didn't realise I was quite so efficient, but being skint does make you efficient, and I was certainly skint growing up.
Okay, let's hear a little bit from Santana. She's Not There. Santana on guitar for She's Not There. Very sophisticated first choice.
What can I tell you? Yeah, I think for me, music back when I was a teenager, it was everything. It really was. I guess, you know, arrived in boarding school, what, a week after my 12th birthday. And I think kind of a light switch went on. Music was your connection to the outside world. And really, I can literally from pre-September 75 to from that, almost that day onwards, I just became a sponge for music, and it became really the connection to the outside world. And we didn't have we had no TV, for example, in boarding school.
What boarding school would be?
Rockwell in Tipperary. No TV, no access to newspapers, believe it or not, right? Which is a strange background for a media person. But anyway, and radios technically were also banned.
But I was just about to ask that. I'm surprised that they used to allow you to listen to music.
Yeah, there was a bit of a loophole, and that is that the cassette recorder, if it had a radio in it, they couldn't quite figure that out because cassettes were allowed. But there was, you were allowed to listen on Sunday evenings to the BBC Countdown, which counted down the top singles. And that was the thing that we hung on. So I could practically list you out every single from September 75 until, I don't know, almost until 1980. It was that strong a connection. So music for me, and it has remained to the present day, you know, it's the thing over and above anything else. It's that incredibly strong emotional connection to music.
And what sort of music from that era?
Well, I mean, the whole Shooting Match. I mean, obviously as a teenager, you'd have to pick Teenage Kicks. That was one of my absolute favourites. I guess I was, what, 13 or 14 when that came out. So it kind of rang a very loud bell with everybody.
And the Undertones being an Irish band.
And the Undertones being an Irish band. I think as well, you know, the 70s, it was a pretty glum time to be Irish. You know, anytime you turn on the news, especially abroad, it was all about the troubles and stuff. And I remember, for example, being in France on one of those student exchange things in 1979, and my little heart bursting with pride to hear the Boomtown Rats' I Don't Like Mondays actually making the top of the charts. And of course, the previous year, Rat Trap had been top of the charts in the UK. And bearing in mind how what a vital connection that was for us and for me, there was a huge sense of pride. And I think music carried that for me, and especially the Irish bands, whether it was, you know, the Undertones or the Rats or indeed Thin Lizzy.
You've given us quite a few favourite albums. Give us a few of them.
Sure. Yeah, I suppose I started with The Bends from Radiohead. This is about 1995. And it's a funny one, Matt, because I suppose, you know, the way, you, as I say, that your teens music is everything and into your 20s, it sort of tails off. Whereas this actually came out in my early 30s. And I kind of thought by then I was beyond being blown away by an album. And The Bends absolutely just threw me for six. And it was the best way I can describe it. It was almost like a hypnotic trance. I'd really never heard anything quite like it. And I think that's about 30 years plus ago, and it still sounds great. In fact, I played it again a few days ago to refresh myself, and it's just fantastic. The lyrics, so you think of songs like Fake Plastic Trees, and there's one of my favorite lines from Planet Telex. It says, "Everything is broken. Everyone is broken." It's just kind of, it's timeless, and also feels oddly timely as well.
It's actually one of my favourite albums as well. Street Spirit will be one of my all-time favourite tracks.
Absolutely.
But the one that we have from the album, probably better known, Fake Plastic Trees.
The green plastic watering can for a fake Chinese rubber plant. In a fake plastic girl, which you bought from a rubber man in a town full of
Fake Plastic Trees by Radiohead from The Bends. Give us other albums. You've given us quite a few mentions.
Yeah. Automatic for the People from REM, 1992. Absolutely fantastic. Sounds as good today as it did when it was released. I loved Madonna. I've always liked Madonna's music, and she's brilliant. And I think it peaked for her, well, for me anyway, with her, with the album Like a Prayer in 1989. It's fantastic. And some of the album tracks, the non-singles on that, are absolutely gold. I also, maybe as grown up in the countryside, but have a teeny tiny grawl for country music. And not all country music, and certainly not country and western, but for example, the Dixie Chicks, or the Chicks as I think they're now known, they produced two albums in the early 2000s, Home and Taking the Long Way, and they're absolutely fantastic. And what I loved about them as well, Matt, is they're so political. They were given the two fingers to the Bush administration in particular, and their attempts to silence dissent after 9/11. And these young women stood up for American values, well, for human values at that time, and they paid a huge price for it.
You're also a big fan of Pink Floyd.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Pink Floyd, I was a little bit young when Dark Side of the Moon was released in 73. So I came to it probably about a decade later. And again, just an amazing, just fabulous, different, just so completely different. And again, it holds up so well over 50 years later. It's an album that I would play on average probably once a month. And it's one of those albums that I will always go somewhere quiet and listen to the whole thing. And I think that's maybe something we've lost a little bit in the Spotify era, is this idea, not of a song or a single, but of whole albums, and of experiencing an album as a continuum rather than sort of diving into the Dolly mixtures of just picking random favourite songs. And I think for people of a certain age, myself included, the album experience is completely different to, as I say, surfing music.
Okay. Well, in that case, tell us who the favourite bands and artists are.
Yeah. I mean, again, obviously some of the ones I've just described, but I would add to that, for example, I've been a huge fan of Simon and Garfunkel, again, before my time, but I have had the good fortune of seeing them. I actually saw them, I think it was in 95 in the RDS, and they were fantastic. But, you know, just the whole Simon Garfunkel thing, again, it predated my time, but the music, it's just so, I don't know, it stays with you all the time. So certainly Simon Garfunkel. Also, staying back in the 60s, absolutely love The Doors. Don't know why, just anytime I want a lift, I put on The Doors. And, you know, it's just one of those bands that always makes you feel better. And I mentioned REM, I mean, Automatic for the People, but they had a slew of albums, and I would regularly listen to them. And probably a band that goes with me all the way back to boarding school in the 70s was the Electric Light Orchestra, ELO.
2 weeks in a row, Pat Kinnevan last week as well.
I know, I heard that, yeah. And it was just an amazing band, like way seriously underrated. I think, you know, they're maybe not regarded as quite as serious an operation as some other bands, but in fact, absolutely brilliant music, timeless sounds, and I find myself going back time and time again to ELO albums from the 1970s, and in fact, one from 1981 called Time, an amazing album.
You've also admitted to a liking for AOR, I think, as they call it, Adult Oriented Rock. Very few people, I don't know anyone has ever admitted on this spot before to liking the likes of Foreigner and Boston.
I know, these are my guilty secrets. Well, first of all, Boston's eponymous album, Boston, Boston, More Than a Feeling and so on, it's just fantastic.
Look Back is their best track.
Well, some would say, but I suppose that's the one that I really like. Foreigner is a funny one, Matt. For some strange reason, my two kind of romantic involvements in the early 1980s. Weirdly enough, the first one coincided with I've Been Waiting for a Girl Like You. I know. And then about 3 or 4 years later, it was the I Want to Know What Love Is. Oh, God, forgive me for saying all this out loud, but it's true. And as a result, I suppose, the it hit the schmaltz button with me, and I'm afraid it's always remained there. So I do, I must admit that I do like that AOR as well. Yeah.
Okay, but then the track we're going to play is from Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, played by the Berlin Philharmonic. Why?
Well, first of all, I love classical music. I guess it goes back probably to influence of my father. And I suppose I walk a lot, and I spend a lot of time at the desk. So classical music is something you can enjoy without being completely distracted by the lyrics. So I listen to a huge amount of classical music, and I suppose Beethoven, I suppose you keep coming back to. I mean, there's lots of others, Dvorak, Mozart and so on. But Beethoven is the big daddy, really, of classical music. And within that, Beethoven's Seventh, it is spine tingling.
Let's hear a bit. Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, as picked by John Gibbons as part of his Culture Club. Best gig you were ever at?
Well, I'll start with the first one, Matt, because it's hard to get away from that first experience, which for me was Thin Lizzy in the Carlton Ballroom in Kilkenny, which is a basic enough venue, let's be honest. But it was in, I remember well, it was in Easter 1980, so it was the midterm break just before the Leaving Cert.
I have to tell you, our series producer, Dermot Doyle, remembers being at the very same gig.
Yes, you beat me to it. So, I mean, what are the odds? But I suppose probably everybody in Kilkenny of a certain age was at that gig. It was incredible. I just remember we were rammed into this little ballroom with a low ceiling and everybody was jumping. The whole place, the floor was moving, everyone was moving, and they gave it socks. They were fantastic. They even had the big brass gong at the back, right, that they hit at one of the things. So again, as a young fella, whatever, 15 or 16, I think it was then, it was an unbelievable experience to see a serious outfit like that in the flesh. And then I suppose...
Well, actually, let's play a bit of Lizzy. That's not from the Carlton Ballroom in Kilkenny. No audio available of that. But it was around the time of their Live and Dangerous tour and album. So here's a track which I think is very apt, considering from many of your critics when they hear you on a Thursday. Don't believe a word. I'd be a Philistine and say that beats Beethoven any day. Okay, what other gigs do you want to recall for us?
Yeah, I suppose my first big kind of outdoor gig was a couple of years later in 82 when I got to see the Rolling Stones in Slane, and also got to stay overnight in a tent in a sort of the whole thing was back in the day was a bit more thrown together. Facilities and stuff were basic, but it was amazing. And again, the Stones, they wouldn't have been a big, I wouldn't have been a big fan at the time. But, you know, for a bunch of old lads, I thought they were great. And my God, 40 years later, they're still going, just shows you. But yeah, that was a terrific concert. And I suppose since then, a few standout ones, Matt, for me would be, as I think I mentioned earlier, I did get to see Simon and Garfunkel. They were amazing. Bruce Springsteen, I've seen him in the RDS, fantastic. But again, the ELO in 2016 in the Three Arena was just out of this world. Was that in the name of an album? Anyway, and also in 2019, actually, probably for sheer stage presence, it's hard to look past Billy Joel in 2019. And he played in Lansdowne Road at the Aviva Stadium. And he was just brilliant. His connection with the audience, his self-deprecation was just brilliant. Also, his voice at that time was still 100%.
Movie, actor, director, what have you gone for here?
Yeah, I picked one again. Maybe it's the schmaltz in me, Matt, but absolutely love The Last of the Mohicans from 1992. That was directed by Michael Mann, who people would know probably way back in the 80s.
Miami
Vice. But he also directed some really serious films, like, for example, Heat in the mid-1990s. But this one really, it's a period drama. And I looked it up, actually. Apparently, there have been 11 film versions of this particular book. But this is far and away the best. An absolutely outstanding Daniel Day-Lewis in the lead role as Hawkeye. And also it gave us a small little cultural nugget. I remember at the time Extra Vision had an ad promoting it when it became available on video. And they did it in the style of a Moore Street seller. And when something like this, anyone there for The Last of the Mohicans? Now, come on, you just can't improve on that. So that probably would be my standout film. Also, the score for it, as I mentioned, I love classical music. And the score for this was jointly composed by Trevor Jones and Randy Edelman, I should say. And they probably would have won the Oscar for soundtrack, except to be nominated for an Oscar, apparently there has to be only a single composer. So unfortunately, it wasn't eligible for the Oscar. But I still listen, probably again, once a month, I would listen to the soundtrack of Last of the Mohicans. It's absolutely brilliant. And probably a little more up to date, Interstellar from 2014, which is directed by Christopher Nolan. Absolutely remarkable, beautiful film. For people not familiar with it, Earth is in trouble. There's dust storms and blight sweeping the planet, and essentially people are facing the proposition of having to leave, having to try to find a home somewhere else. What I particularly liked about it is that while they stretch things a little bit, it was written within the laws of physics. So there's some very strange playing with the concepts of time and relativity, but they remain faithful to the laws of physics. So from the point of view of a science geek like myself, it's such a treat. And also, of course, visually, it's just beautiful.
Let's hear a little clip from that with Matt Damon, Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway.
Dr. Mann, do not open the hatch. If you open the hatch, the airlock will depressurize.
Good.
Okay, pull back. Retro thrusters, everything we've got, Case.
Retros at full.
Back.
Case, relay my transmission to the onboard computer and have it rebroadcast as emergency PA. Dr. May.
Open the inner hatch. I repeat, do not open the inner hatch.
Brand? I don't know what he said to you,
but I'm taking command of the Endurance.
And then we can talk about completing the mission.
Dr. Mann, listen to me.
This is not about my life or Cooper's life. This is about all mankind.
Interstellar. Okay, why have you picked Glengarry Glen Ross as your favourite play?
Yeah, I think it's one probably that just really resonated with me very strongly. I think I saw it a long number of years ago, and it was early days in when I was setting up my own business at the time, and somebody had to do the sales job, and that ended up being me. I was a bit of a reluctant salesman. And of course, Glengarry Glen Ross famously is about, these real estate salesmen essentially killing each other for a break, for a lead. And it's quite a vicious little play, but brilliant. And that one really stayed in my mind.
Okay, there's a version from Broadway from 2012 and 2013, which I was lucky enough to be at, with Al Pacino and David Harbour in this scene.
What is that? All that I'm saying is
what
is this?
You say.
What is that? What is that? A deal kicks out. I gotta eat shit. Williamson? Shit? You. Moss, Roma, look at the sheets. Look at the sheets, 1980, 81, 82, 6 months, 82. Who's there? Who's up there?
Roma.
Under him.
Moss.
Bullshit, John. Bullshit. April, September, 1981. It isn't fucking Moss, due respect. It's me. It's me, John.
Yeah, Moss. Not lately it isn't.
Kiss my ass. Lately. Lately.
A little bit there of Glengarry Glen Ross, Al Pacino, and David Harbour. But you also, you must like the ones, the wordy ones, wordy rather than worthy. To Kill a Mockingbird, the Aaron Sorkin production recently, given that his adaptation pretty much, The West Wing, of course, is what he's most famous for.
That's right. Yeah, no, this was in the Borgosh Theatre. It was terrific, although a little disconcerting in 2026 to hear the N-word on stage repeatedly, quite honestly. I don't know how you get around that kind of thing, but just it's jarring. But it was a fantastic production. There's no question about that. As I say, I wouldn't be the world's greatest theatre goer by any means. And, you know, I guess I do like the musicals as well, like Les Miserables. I got to see it in the West End in London a few years ago, and it was just amazing, like as a family experience. And I'm booked in. Somebody kindly got me Christmas presents of tickets for the Les Mis in, again, I think it's in the Three Arena in June. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Okay. We have a lot of crossovers and things up until I think where we get to books.
Hmm.
So tell us about the books you love.
Yeah, love maybe is one word for it. I suppose I think of the books that have influenced me hugely, and I suppose the one that I keep coming back to is a book that was published in about the year 2000, and it was called Something New Under the Sun by J.R. McNeill, Georgetown University, and it was essentially a history of the biosphere in the 20th century. It doesn't sound like the most exciting topic you've ever heard, but for some reason, Matt, it just knocked me off my feet. And this is at a time long before I had ever written a single word in anger or spoken in public on any environmental topic. And this one, it wasn't really about climate change as such. It was more about the human impacts on the biosphere and how they were rapidly intensifying. So that kind of set me down a road that obviously, you know, I've continued on for more than the last 20 years. So it was very influential. In a similar theme, I suppose, I think of The World Without Us by Alan Weisman, which is, a sort of a academic exercise in imagining what would happen if humans, for example, were to simply disappear without a trace tomorrow. What would happen to the world? How would nature reset things over time? And maybe that's less hypothetical than we might think. I also admit I do like the political writers. I like John Pilger. He was certainly an influence of mine many years ago. And I think back to a book called Heroes of his that I really enjoyed. I did get to meet him.
Yeah, that was the mid-1980s.
That's right, yeah. And I think I encountered it in about 1990, and I got to meet John Pilger a number of years ago in Dublin at an event that he spoke at.
Yeah, I became increasingly sceptical about his writing over the years.
Likewise, Matt. But I'm talking, this is vintage Pilger.
Yeah, and that was his peak.
Absolutely.
It all went downhill from there.
No, for sure. And that's why I specifically attributed some of his early stuff. And you do find that with people. They start out one way and they end up in a different way.
I do remember one of my college lecturers in DCU or NIHES at the time actually saying that John Pilger's greatest hero was himself.
Mm.
But they did subsequently give him an honorary doctorate in DCU as well.
Sure. So I suppose Naomi Klein, I think as well, is a terrific writer and thinker and agitator. I think, you know, she's brought sort of political activism and made it very accessible to a lot of people, obviously famously for No Logo. There's various other books that she's written. No Is Not Enough was one of the more recent ones that I read by her. And then, if you like, as a science writer, one of the absolute best is Elizabeth Colbert of the New Yorker magazine.
Well, let's actually just hear an extract from her book, Sixth Extinction.
Then the frogs around Elvaye started to disappear. The problem, it was not yet perceived as a crisis, was first noticed to the west, near Panama's border with Costa Rica. An American graduate student happened to be studying frogs in the rainforest there. She went back to the States for a while to write her dissertation, and when she returned, she couldn't find any frogs, or for that matter, amphibians of any kind. She had no idea what was going on, but since she needed frogs for her research, she set up a new study site, farther east. At first, the frogs at the new site seemed healthy. Then the same thing happened. The amphibians vanished. The blight spread through the rainforest until, in 2002, the frogs in the hills and streams around the town of Santa Fe, about 50 miles west of Elvaye, were effectively wiped out. In 2004, little corpses began showing up even closer to Elvaye, around the town of El Copé. By this point, a group of biologists, some from Panama, others from the United States, had concluded that the golden frog was in grave danger. They decided to try to preserve a remnant population by removing a few dozen of each sex from the forest and raising them indoors. But whatever was killing the frogs was moving even faster than the biologists had feared. Before they could act on their plan, the wave hit.
That is from The Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Colbert. Is that why you went to Costa Rica recently chasing the frogs?
Well, I guess, you know, reading great writers like Elizabeth Colbert would certainly have been part of my inspiration, Matt, for sure. Again, I love journalists like her who've done the fieldwork, who've been to places like, whether it's the rainforests or down in Antarctica, not as tourists, not as showboaters, but doing the hard graft with the scientists.
We're nearly out of time. Television, you missed a lot of television by being a boarding school. Well, what do you remember from being young?
Yeah, I suppose I think back to the theme tune to Hawaii Five-O. That was usually around the time that my father would start shouting at you to get that it was time for bed. It would remind him to get rid of us. But I did love Hawaii Five-O. Also, I was at that age, Matt, where I remember the arrival of colour television, which was the closest thing anyone will ever experience in their lifetime to the arrival of aliens. It was such a marvellous, happy experience. That would have been one of them, I suppose. Other shows, as you mentioned, there is a bit of a gap there during the teenage years. But I love shows like, for example, Hill Street Blues, beautifully made, although, again, in hindsight, maybe a little bit of police washing in there as well. And of course,
Just be careful out there.
Of course. I think of Dallas as well. We were all kind of stuck with Dallas in the 1980s. And I suppose I would make the point with the Matt that it did bear out my hunch that the oil business is full of rogues and scoundrels.
And you also mentioned The Office. So let's play a brief clip for David Brent, played by Ricky Gervais, addressing new employees who've joined the slow office in Swindon.
Welcome to Slough, to the new people. My name's David Brent. And I've always been in the paper industry. Haven't I? Yeah. My parents owned a paper shop until it blew away. Paper. There's better ones than that. Okay. Yeah, I'm not used to public squeaking. I piss pronunciate a lot of my worms.
Ooh.
Do you know, that's the two Ronnies. Do you know like that? That is classic stuff. Turn the phone off. That's part of it. If you're not concentrating, you're not going to enjoy it as much. Focus. Okay. Anyway, good to have you all here from Swindon, because I hear they dropped an atomic bomb on Swindon. About 15 quid's worth of damage. Right, okay.
Okay, to finish, a buried treasure. Give us something unexpected, please.
Yeah, I'm not sure how unexpected it is, but I picked this one out as a buried treasure because I don't think it's received the TLC, the love and attention that it deserves. And it's a book from 2017 called Whittled Away, Ireland's Vanishing Nature by Pádraig Fógarty, the ecologist, who I'm sure many of your listeners will have heard speaking on various things. But it's a really beautifully written lyrical account of both nature in Ireland and also its sad decline. And certainly for me, reading it was a real eye-opener as to the situation that we're in. Very realistic, very accurate. Again, based, just like Elizabeth Colbert, based on fieldwork, lots of fieldwork, lots of ground-based research, which is, again, the vital component in good environmental reporting.
Like your own book, The Lie of the Land. It's been great having you, John Gibbons. That flew along. We'll see you back here tomorrow for your weekly environment spot.
The Last Word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.